right, so welcome to what will end up being the last episode of our first season of Mentioned in Dispatches. We had grand designs of going for 10 episodes per season, but we're running up against the holidays here at episode 8. And so we're going to declare success for our first season with episode 8. I mean, look, the site's not even 4 months old, right? So, you know, we'll take what we can get out of that first season. And so here to help us wrap it up tonight, we have our good buddy, Michael, a couple of time zones away. Howdy, Michael.
Yo.
Yo. And, you can find him in the forums as Banzai Cat. And then one of our Armchair Dragoons regulars here on Mentioned in Dispatches, our good buddy Cyrano. Howdy, Jim.
I love the sound of Mentioned in Dispatches.
Yes, yes, I'm sure you do. And back for an unofficial visit, our good buddy, James Starrett. Howdy, James.
Hello.
And we don't have to clear this one through official channels or anything, right? This is just a couple of guys talking
games. I think anything that anybody attributes to me in this, if they attribute it to anybody else, they will be laughed at.
Yes.
Even more than normal. This is me and just me.
Yes, mockery is a strong motivator in some cases. So I promised our buddy Cyrano no ambush questions tonight. So I'm not going to throw any provocative Napoleonic statements at him. Instead, I've got something else I want to ask about. And James, really, this actually does kind of overlap with some of what you deal with on a day-to-day basis. But I asked this in the forums, and we got a couple of slight responses, but I really think it goes a little deeper than what was being discussed in the forums. But Cold War Goes Hot in Europe seems to be making a comeback in the wargaming world these days. And not updated for contemporary conflict, because we do have things like the Putin's War series that have been, you know, thrown out there. Next War Poland, Millennium War is Ukraine. Eastern Europe aflame in the early part of the millennium. We've got a variety of those games. But if you look at it, Under an Iron Sky, the remake of NATO, the Lock and Load relaunching the World at War 85 series, look, we've been using Flashpoint campaigns at Origins for years now. Cold War Goes Hot in the 80s in Europe seems to be making a bit of a comeback these days. And I think it's got to go beyond just, oh, well, the Russians are getting frisky again, so let's play out how these shootouts would look. Because we do have games that already give us that sort of scenario. And yet we're still seeing the 80s, you know, 70s and 80s era games popping back up. And so, James, we'll start with you and work our way around the virtual room here. Any thoughts, ideas, guesses as to why this might be starting to make a comeback?
Nostalgia. It's looking at the era when most of us were teenagers. The second question I would put to you is, why is it that specifically they tend to focus on the mid to late 80s? And part of that is that it's not only nostalgia, it's an era that we can look at through rosy-tinged glasses, because it's one of the few eras when we're confident we would have won. Because if you look at, say, 55 or 65 or 75, people will start to sort of shuffle in their shoes about what the outcome might have been, particularly when they start to get serious about it. But in 85, 88, that time period which people, strangely enough, love to go to, it's not just that it's the end of the Cold War and therefore they've got an official, oh, well, it was almost over. It's also that it's a period of time in which we are pretty confident that we had an advantage in both technology and training.
Yeah, certainly not in manpower.
No, but it's when you've got things like the M1 and the Leopard 2 coming online, and you've got some of the wonderful training programs that we put into effect. And I'm not being sarcastic about that at all. They were really good training programs that were really coming on stream in a way that if you look at earlier eras, really is not the case. And you can go back to earlier eras and at various points point at, hey, they've got a technological edge on us, and potentially their training is not as different as ours. So the late 80s is in some ways this golden era. So the cynical side of me suggests that it's a combination of nostalgia and is nostalgia looking back to a perceived golden age.
Yeah, I think the one of the tough lessons you see in U.S. military history is that the first fight of every war, we get our ass kicked. And I think one of the brilliant, you know, long-term training maneuvers there of establishing the NTC is, you know, let's get our ass kicked when it's laser tag and not real bullets.
Absolutely.
And that seems to have definitely paid dividends over the long run. Jim, what do you think?
I have not thought with a fraction of the depth that that James has been compelled to occupationally on this subject. But my own reaction, I remember vividly being in forensics in the 82, 83, 84 window. And one of the perennial debate topics is NATO a paper tiger? And pulling up endless reams of articles and defense analyses that showed something you were talking about, Brandt, those force ratios and all those things that were, you know, how are we going to beat the bear and all those other things. And I don't know the historiography well enough to say how much of this is looking at the telescope backwards. But I can certainly say this much. I agree absolutely that it's partially demographic. These were contemporary games. NATO Division Commander is a contemporary game for me. You know, that was something that could happen. That was not a historical exercise. Third World War, a contemporary exercise. What might happen if they come pouring through the Fulda Gap? And so there's certainly that demographic shift that now that we're older and we look back, as you say, as was said with some nostalgia, I'm going to have to think a little bit more about the certainty of that was the time we were certain of victory, because as we were discussing it as lay people, for want of a better phrase, not military people, but as people trying to think about these geopolitical issues, we never, in my recollection, regarded victory as a certainty. In fact, there was a substantial number of people that I would engage with, again, non-military, obviously, based on what I'm going to say, that felt, look, the Russians are going to win if they come. And I would call this the 82 to 83 window. Mm-hmm. And if they come and they win, well, it's better not to take the losses. It's let them have the counterinsurgency problem.
Yeah.
Whether it be in Western Europe or in Great Britain. And, of course, John Milius's fantasies notwithstanding North America.
A clarification there is that the games present us as being ready to win it. I agree that back in the era, we were definitely, at least I was definitely, uncertain. I don't think I was anywhere near as deeply engaged in the analysis in the 80s as you were, from what you're saying. But
no, it's an interesting thing because those debates, well, I guess maybe this is as far as I'd go. We know how the story turned out. We saw behind what was really there. And you know, you would think that since 1989 we would have seen so much more information come online, but it's taken decades, in fact, you know, 30 years now, for so much of it, and some of it is still lost to us due to language barriers and things. I'm thinking of this particularly in the context of I'm making my way through Max Hastings' Vietnam right now, which is, as all of his stuff, you can agree with it, you can disagree with it, it ain't boring.
nope.
And what he, you know, some of the things he says about the alignments, about the technology, about the fears, and about the greatest question in all of warfare, which is what's going on the other side of the hill, I think we do now have the advantage. We're not speculating as much about what those setups were. We knew what they were, and we can begin to have the historical benefits. So you combine our own native love fascination with that period, with the fact that now we can start to piece it together and get it right and have a lot of old sweat suddenly go, oh, that's what you bastards were doing. Okay, I get it. And they say the same thing to us. that you've got a pretty strong combination that argues in favor of revisiting that era.
Michael, I know you've played a bunch of these games, and we've discussed plenty of them on other podcasts, as well as just, you know, talking about games at different times. What do you think? Is this a nostalgia thing? Is this a we would have liked to have actually won something thing? What do you think?
Well, there's no way I'm going to go into a level of detail like these two gentlemen have. That's definitely more in their wheelhouse than me. But as far as I know, I could tell you, I think it's a nostalgia thing for sure. But also, you had said something about, you know, keeping current events out of mind, but I think that has something to do with it as well. Russian threats in the Ukraine and such that obviously would bring a game like Putin Strikes West or East or whatever is out there to the forefront. So,
yeah. Otherwise
titled that game that Ty Bomba has published this week.
Yeah.
Oh God, no.
And which Polly over at RT.com has attempted to review. and apparently which Lou Cotney thinks is the definitive work on reviewing the game there as well, since, you know, RT is in fact a valid and reasonable news source.
Be careful, I have a production credit with RT. Allow me to tell you that story someday.
Yeah, that's gonna need some booze. My soapbox that I've jumped on occasion around this is we see M1 tanks on those counters in the 80s, and we see M1 tanks floating around the force today, and we think, oh, these things are totally interchangeable. And in fact, if you go back from today, and Jim, you mentioned this a minute ago, so this is 30 years ago that the Cold War was going down. If we go back to when a lot of us picked up war games in the early and mid-80s, and then back up from there 30 years, you're into Korea, which is, you know, multiple generations of warfare away from where we were in the Cold War. And with all of the changes that go on in life over the past 30 years, do we really think warfare hasn't evolved all that significantly from mid-80s to today that we still lump them all into one sort of general era? And I see people talk about it all the time. They want to pull out the GDW Third World War series and try to just use that to refight some hypothetical scenario if Putin charges west. And I'm just, I don't see those things as being close enough in time that they should be treated as equal. Jim, what do you think?
Oh yeah, I think that's absolutely strange. I'll go back just because it's in my head right now. I actually leapt from Max Hastings' Catastrophe, his first World War book, into Vietnam. Now, as everybody knows, I'm a Napoleonicist. So, you know, the British century, the historian's 19th century is 1815 to 1914. Everything after that is notionally modern. Well, we all know the astonishing amount of change that went on between 1914 and today, and, you know, the last 100 years of warfare. Well, we then say, well, how about if we cut it in half? How about if we go 1914 to the end, say, of the Second World War? You know, how about that? Well, you could probably stretch it to Korea, but the reality is by the time you get the air mobile concept in the Vietnam War, now you're seeing some really big evolutions. But if you're going to tell me that the army that fought, or, you know, the forces that fought, the doctrines that met at Ott Bock in 1962 are in any way similar, other than the fact that it's still men with guns and vehicles and things like that, to the individuals that fought in Gulf One. I mean, that's insanity.
Yeah.
But even if you get more granular than that, I am pretty immersed right now in relearning Battlefront's Shock Force 2. Which, despite what everybody says, was an incredible gift to the gaming community by Battlefront. Something they had to do. They had such a horrible release all those years ago, and they fixed it, and then now they're even fixing it more. But it is amazing just comparing some of the stories some of my friends tell me about contemporary deployments, things that they've worked with, the events depicted in Shock Force 2 are more than living memory. They're almost, historically speaking, yesterday. And yet already the armies that we're seeing deploying around the world are very different from them. The vehicles, sure, but also the way that they're using them, the way that they're – all these pieces are changing to respond to new circumstances. So, yeah, there is absolutely a fundamental risk of getting it wrong if you – I'll go back to your phrase – take the silhouette and say, yep, that looks like an M1, so it must be the same type of warfare.
Yeah. I think when you're comparing it against, you know, the grand scope of human history, you know, there are – some of those crusty old grogs out there that'll tell you the modern era starts with gunpowder, right?
Sure.
But
sure. And there's a truth in that. That's not false.
Well, yeah.
You know, there's warfare never is, you know, if you read Keegan's grand book, his History of Warfare, he makes that emphatically clear.
Yeah.
And other historians before him did the same. It's just, but I think we want to cut it into these sweeping pieces, and what we fail to acknowledge, especially in our technological age, that level of change is not merely still there, it's accelerating.
I think one of the reasons we slice things into those boxes and where the modern term had gotten bandied about is for much of history, we can, especially wargamers, because we're talking about the wars, we build the era of wargaming around the war we're talking about. We have American Civil War, we have Revolutionary War, we have Napoleonic Wars, we have whatever conflict. And so, you know, once you get to the 20th century, you've got World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, you know, the African Bush Wars, whatever. Once you get post-Vietnam, we just sort of lumped all that into modern, because at the time the games were being published, they were modern. You know, they were talking about today. 30, 40 years later, I don't think we can call those modern necessarily anymore. I do think that the fall of the wall helped us out by giving us a breakpoint at which we could say the Cold War sort of ended. We weren't expecting it to reboot 15, 20 years later. But we kind of called that, you know, the Cold War era, and that made sense in our heads of kind of when we drew that line. But again, M1 silhouettes on the counters then, M1 silhouettes on the counters now. Hey, look, we're still doing the same stuff. We're really not. So, Michael, what do you think? Jump in here. Like I said, you've played a bunch of these games. You know, I mean,
what was the question again?
There wasn't really a question. There was a what do you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of out of it. Sorry.
Yeah. More cold meds. More cold meds.
Yeah, that's just what I need.
I guess that's
a good question. I mean, it's kind of getting way down too far into the weeds to make distinctions between different time periods, I think. I mean, you could, and this is totally arguable because I'm kind of new to the whole Franco-Prussian War thing, but you could say that there's quite a bit of difference between that and, say, the American Civil War, even though they're very close together time-wise. It's not just a time thing. It's a regional thing as well, obviously. Much different case between the North and the South fighting as it was with the French and the Prussians, much different militaries, much different outlook on campaigns and such. So, as far as games are concerned, you know, I get to try my hand at that a look here and there. I've been much more of a World War II type of person over most of my life, but I've only recently started to branch out a little bit more. Not quite comfortable enough to get into the Napoleonics yet, even though I did try early on. I had a, tried to get into a game of Empire in Arms once, Jim, and that didn't work out well. I was told, what's that?
I want to know that story, but.
Well, it was a group of my friends at the time who were into it, and they said it was a game that was ongoing for about 7 months, and they had an opening, and I want to say it was for Turkey, for sure. The Ottomans, and yeah. I thought, well, I'll try it. And they said, I think they ended up not playing the rest of the game. And it wasn't because of me. It was just because they just, you know, they just kind of lost interest in it. So, you know, you got games like that just are life forms unto themselves that I don't know. it really depends on the gamer and their own personal likes and dislikes, obviously, which is a very difficult thing to court when you're a game developer, I think. I mean, you look at somebody like Compass Games, who's churning out tons and tons and tons of products. It seems every day I see something new on Facebook from them. Then more specifically, you got the little things like, say, Empire in Arms or Diplomacy or, you know, something like that that carves out a little niche market to it. You can't really pigeonhole these things. I don't even know if I'm making much sense right now.
Ah, pop another Sudafed. You'll be fine.
Yeah, thanks. That's not what I need right now. But
James, you've heard us babble about this a little bit. What do you think?
So a couple thoughts, one of which is temporal compression. We have a tendency to see things that are in the recent past as being more spread out and more different than similar or even far larger spans of time in the further past. So I can imagine, at least in theory, that you might have Athenian strategoi who were arguing over the latest changes in the design of hoplite armor or some such and thinking, well, you know, there's been a revolution in military affairs because of a change in the way they were designing the armor or a new way of building a trireme or so on and so forth, and thinking that it invalidated the rest of the Bronze Age. And in a similar manner, we tend to compress things that have been going on recently. A argument we used to get into in grad school in the pub was whether or not Commander X from some earlier era would be as competent today if you simply picked that person up and dropped them in front of a then modern force. And for whatever reason, there's somebody whose hobby horse it was. I've forgotten exactly who the other student was that Alexander the Great would be perfectly competent at leading a modern army. And in fact, I don't agree with that. I think there's been enough of a change in both what's going on in warfare and in particular the role of the commander since Alexander's time that he would do very poorly because Alexander fundamentally tried to lead from the front, which has been suicidal for a century or so.
Yeah, these days gets you shot.
Yeah, these days it gets you shot, and the fact that you've shown to the few troops who are in view of you that you were very brave in going forward to get shot doesn't really do the army as a whole much good. So on the one hand, I am sympathetic to the argument that, gosh, so much has changed since 1990. On the other hand, there is a side of me which remains skeptical about the scale of the change. I don't think that we have seen necessarily a change on the scale of what overcame, say, from 1850 to 1950. Because in that era, you've got changes that I think change the nature of warfare more completely. You're going from railways are just entering the picture to atom bombs. You're going from horse-drawn logistics to logistics that are using aircraft and trucks and railroads. You're going from messages speeding at the speed of a horse to messages going by radio with, by the point you're at 1950, at least a reasonable degree of encryption is possible, whether or not somebody's cracking it on the other side. So there's a reason that people look at quote-unquote World War II, loosely World War II, Korea, that era, and start to say, you know, it looks recognizably quote-unquote modern, even though you don't have, say, cyber warfare or precision munitions or attack helicopters or whatever other whiz-bang tech you're going to bring in. I'm not sure how much those have changed things since 1990. And in part, that's a uncertainty on my part of how sustainable they are, which is an argument in which I have, in fact, no information other than to note that in all the previous wars, people expected ammunition expenditures to be X and generally found that they were a very great large multiple of X when they hit the actual contest.
Yes.
Yeah, I think what's happened there and speaking as a guy who's done some log work at various points in my career, there's always this this tendency to underestimate the ammo consumption based on rate of fire. Generally, whatever rate of fire you can sustain, people will, just because they can, not necessarily because they should. Because if you have the option to, you know, shove that many more bullets downrange at the other guy, you do it. So the I wrote a column some number of years ago for a strategy page back when I was writing for them. So this 15 years ago at least, that really World War One was one of the big dividing lines for those revolutions in military affairs, in large part because that's one of the major breakpoints at which warfare went from two dimensions to three dimensions, because that was the point at which aircraft and submarines really became normal on the battlefield. They weren't one-off oddities that we were experimenting with, but they became an integrated part of the force. And suddenly you weren't just maneuvering on the flat map. Now all of a sudden you had to pay attention to what was above and below. And that was really a big, big sea change, you know, kind of break point there in warfare, that we may not have rivaled since.
So. Brent, I would go beyond that. This is putting on my historian hat. The World War One is the defining event of the 20th century, and there's very little to rival it, not only militarily, but socially and politically.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Look, I had 500 words to work with in the column I was writing, so it was only so much I could cover. But part of it was that, you know, the point I was making in the column was that a lot of the highly touted revolutions in military affairs around digital communication technology, they were all well and good in terms of how fast we could get information out to people, but they were speeding up existing warfare. They weren't fundamentally changing it the way the 3D-ification of warfare in World War One happened. That was my primary comparison point, was that we've had much bigger revolutions in the past. That was really where I was going with that. So,
but I think both to James's point and also to offer my own slightly different take on it, I think a lot of that stuff goes to having to look at the telescope backwards, mm-hmm. because you're not going to know until it happens. The one thing that is clear is that there's a sense that everybody was shocked by the carnage and the length. And the ensuing carnage, both from time and from technology that was caused in that first year of the First World War. But Max Hastings points out that there are quite a few military theorists and practitioners on both sides that are saying to those above them at higher echelons and are filing reports saying, I don't know what you're talking about with respect to, oh, this is going to be, you know, we'll be home by the time the leaves fall. You know, the Kaiser can be as crazy as you want him to be, and certainly there's nobody at those higher echelons that ever has that foresight to say this, but there are many below them on all sides that are looking at the example of the American Civil War, some who came over here to watch it,
yep,
who say there is no universe in which these societies, which have been, in Keegan's words, trying to pivot into real war into true war, that those individuals that are trying to make this pivot, you're not having fast wars anymore. That we've crossed that sluice gate, and from now on out, it's going to be bad, bloody, and long for a combination of factors. The three-dimensionality of the field, the mass production of weapons, the mass conscription of armies, all these other things suddenly take warfare in a direction that was foreseen by some. But again, we see that backwards now. I'm going to be very interested. I won't be around to see it, but I would be very interested to see where the history books of, what do I want to say, 2150? You know, where do they look back and say, where were our breakpoints? There's no doubt they will see World War One as one of those from the 20th century, but where will our latter half be, and where will they see you know, true modern warfare and what characterizes it and where, what are our big breaks?
So we've talked a bunch about sort of the historical viewpoints, some of the theory of what we thought people were thinking at the time and how gamers approach the view of it all. Let's talk a little war games. Michael, what was your favorite Cold War era war game?
NATO was the next war in Europe. I say that without hesitation because I played it so many times back in the day.
So the
and it wasn't necessarily a reason of like choice because there wasn't a lot of, well, I mean there were quite a few, but not a lot as you have today games on this very subject. I mean, I'm thinking of like Division, for example, by 3W, which was a little more focused and on a totally different region. This was, you know, Central Europe. It was, you could sit down and you could play it in pretty much one sitting, and you could simulate air landings and airstrikes and nuclear war, even if you wanted to go to that point. It was just a very good, contained, short kind of a taste of what that might be like.
Yeah. So you're talking the classic Victory Games one.
Yes, VG. Yep, not the newer one. That's, I think there's a remake that just came out.
I think they're still working on it. I'm not sure it's out yet.
Yeah.
I think they're still working on it. I think at the high division, the theater level, that's certainly one that lots of people look back at with some fair amount of you know, fond memories there. Jim, Cold War wargaming. I know it doesn't have a short Corsican in it, but
Well, I mean, it's a Cold War. It's certainly not Cold War gone hot, as described. But to me, it'll always be in that era. Victory Games is Vietnam.
Yeah.
I don't know as there's a better modern wargame.
Yeah.
Than that, in terms of what it's trying to do. I'm speaking here of the scenarios. Because, as I think I've mentioned on this podcast, I remember hearing an interview with the game's designer who said, yeah, we never really play-tested the campaign. You know, it was not so much finished as released. And so the campaign can take you in some very, very weird directions. But as much as I think Silver Bayonet is an absolutely terrific game, system, I don't think that anything for me has touched Victory Games' Vietnam. I've played a couple games, couple turns of their Korea, which is very good, and then pushing all the way over to the front. I did take a crack at having NATO Division Commander taught to me.
You're glutton for punishment there.
You'll note, I was having none of learning it myself. I was in no position to buy it anyway, although I was deeply enamored of the, as you can well imagine, of the double blind concept. But, it is, to me, that's a more of a concept than a game. But if and I did once, take a, you know, so yeah, I'll just go with those.
Well, you see, In the conversation we were just having before we pivoted to talking games, you know, one of the things that I think you look at there is that if we're talking Cold War wargaming, like I wouldn't have brought up anything from Korea or Vietnam because to me that's Korea and Vietnam and that's not Cold War stuff, which picks up post Vietnam and takes you through, you know, to 1990-91 kind of time frame, takes you up to Gulf One. You know, if I'm thinking Cold War stuff, yes, technically I get that the Cold War was going on as an historical period, but that's not kind of where I would draw those breakpoints for the games because I think of VG's Vietnam, great game, but that's a game about Vietnam. That's not a game about the Cold War of the U.S. and the Russians going at it, you know, with each other. And so, yeah, this is Brant being Captain Pedantic again. I totally get that. Like, you know, guilty as charged and it's always going to happen. But that's where I would see that slightly different. James, any particular favorites that you enjoyed throwing down?
Yeah, well, I'll start with commentary in part on NATO Division Commander, which I not only have played, I have made the strange experiment of playing it double blind against myself, which requires a certain degree of schizophrenia. It's a really neat idea. It is underdeveloped. I do not to this day understand why it is that they needed two separate die rolls on two separate CRTs in order to do combat resolution, because the differences between those tables, the first one introduces minuscule changes to the second. However, it is a neat idea. And somewhere long, long ago, I was told that the CIA used to use it to try to explain people coming in who had no prior experience with the military why it is that things didn't happen quickly and in the way that you expected, because it showed off chaos apparently pretty well from their perspective. No idea if that's true, false, or in between. Some of the Cold War games that stick with me at a couple different levels. The first is Assault, GDW and Frank Chadwick's old game, which on one hand I have warm memories of as playing as a teenager, but second, having come back to it and looked at it again and much more recently, I am struck by just how well much of it is done. The scale, both in ground and in time, the scale of the units, the combat system, all of that do a pretty nifty job of being about spot on and being about as simple as they can get away with being and still showing off the interactions they need to show off. So my respect for that design has grown. A personal favorite of mine has long been Bruce Maxwell's Air and Armor West End. It's a spectacular design if you want to get people struggling back and forth. There's a good dose of Fog of War in it, and you'll see people struggle to figure out how to concentrate force against the enemy and overcome them without getting their faces punched in return by the defensive fire. At a strategic level, I never do well with it, but I think it's a spectacular design. There's Twilight Struggle to cover the entire Cold War. We couldn't get away without mentioning that.
Not a war not game. No, I'm sorry. I was just
say again.
I said not a war game.
Yeah, Brad and I said it. Brad and I said it at the same time. It's not a war game.
I disagree.
I
full stop.
You are incorrect.
I was just being churlish because
of conflict, and it's a game. It's a war game. Driving on. So the on the computer, I have a very warm spot for TAC Ops. I spent many happy years with that and ran things online for it. I'm interested to hear Victory Games Vietnam come up and held up as the ultimate Vietnam game. On the one hand, I did learn a very pointed lesson from it because a friend and I set out to play the entire campaign, and we got through 1 year, and I played in the U.S. and had this, I thought, very clever plan in which I basically turned the entirety of South Vietnam into a free fire zone. And by the end of the year, I had wiped out every single Viet Cong unit on the map and many of the NVA units. And the rest of them were staying in North Vietnam, so I couldn't. So I was feeling pretty proud of myself until the political result came in at the end of the year. And we discovered that he was about to, because I pissed off South Vietnamese so much, get every single Viet Cong unit in the counter mix. Coming back at me, which was a good pointed reminder. But on the other hand,
I was going to say, I would have thought that'd be the result.
That was the result, and it was perfectly correct. But for a teenage me, that was a good lesson.
Sure.
But these days, I would hold up Fire in the Lake as a better game on Vietnam.
Yeah, at that high strategic level, probably. I could totally see that. I wasn't really wanting to start, you know, the 14th Holy War of whether or not Twilight Struggle is a war game. I was just channeling those churlish board game geek guys that always want to bring up the argument every, you know, seems like a quarterly sort of thing that's required to go off around there. That always seems to happen. I'll tell you, one of the things that I always enjoyed about the operational level games, I always enjoyed the 5th Corps games. For two reasons. I really liked the friction point mechanic. I thought it did a good job of sort of showing units kind of grinding to a halt after a certain point, and it did a fair job of modeling the logistics requirements of sooner or later these guys don't just run out of, you know, they're just getting exhausted, but they're out of ammo, they're out of gas, they're out of food, they're out of whatever, as these things kind of grind to a halt. But one of the other things I really liked about the Fifth Corps series is it treated the Cav properly. The Cav showed up not as large units, but they broke them down to their individual Cav troops. They didn't have a whole squadron running around out there, or God forbid the entire regiment. They actually put them out in the size units with which they would deploy where they needed to be. And I thought the Fifth Corps series did a really good job of demonstrating that. Like James, I am quite enamored of Aaron Armor. Got a copy of it on the shelf over here behind me. I also, down at the tactical level, West End Games Fire Team, I thought was an excellent game, for the way it modeled, that squad. It's the squad leader of the Cold War. And I thought it did a great job of modeling those squad level tactics. Assault as sort of the Panzer Blitz of the Cold War. Again, James nailed all the right descriptors there, and I can just sort of skip it and keep going. I will say I think the World at War series has done a fair job of bringing back some of the enthusiasm we all had for Assault. And I'm interested to see the re-release, the World at War 85 re-release that Lock and Load has coming out literally imminent. And see where they, you know, where David and the gang take the World at War 85 series. I think it's going to be fun to see what comes with that. Of the crop of new stuff coming out on the horizon, Jim, do you have any particular favorites that you're really looking forward to?
Oh, first of all, I'm going to pull my own drive-by and say I buy Marco Arnardo's definition, which is a war game, makes me feel like I'm playing a war game, and Twilight Struggle never does. I drive on. I'm really going to be thinking a long time about whether I like Fire in the Lake or Vietnam better, because I like them both so terribly much. I think I'm going to probably sit down and say a Grand Strategic, you're right, but I also periodically, on a scenario-to-scenario basis, I'll always like playing Vietnam just because it gives me the geography I'm always thinking about when I'm reading the books. But as to the new ones, I've told David Heath this at two consecutive origins, where's my Eisenbach Gap?
Well, you're not going to have Eisenbach Gap.
Yeah, we obviously have some folks who...
You're not going to get Eisenbach Gap because they're rebooting it with real maps.
Right, right. And that's you know, I'm saying that aesthetic, that look... Because we obviously have, you know, friends and Armchair Dragoon's family that have participated in the development of that game, and I've got the whole original boot set.
Yeah.
Except may I note Untold Stories. Very frustrating. But I've always very much liked that system. I have no way of knowing what the interactions are, whether they're accurate or not. But I know it's a great fun playing system, and it makes me feel like I'm moving those vehicles and troops around in a way that I should be. Whether I am or not, I'll let others more competent than I judge, but I do enjoy it, and I was looking forward to a reboot in that family or in that look and feel.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure we're going to see that. We just hope sooner rather than later. One thing, this is a little peculiar to me, you know, compared to the rest of you guys from, you know, again, mid-80s, I was living in Germany. Dad was in the military, stationed over there. So when we talk about Cold War goes hot in Europe, that's something that was very real to me and to a lot of my friends in a way that I'm not sure is as real to anyone that wasn't in uniform at the time. But one of the things I always got a kick out of was whenever we would get one of those mid-Germany maps released, we'd immediately open it up and start trying to find home on the maps. You know, who's the nearest unit deploying to where we live, and are they defending correctly, and where are they, and what are they doing, and You know, do we have everybody accounted for in there somewhere? Hey, that highway doesn't go there. And you know that because you ride the bus on that highway every day getting to and from school. So it was always fun to do sort of the ground truth check of, let me open up the map and find where I live. That was always a little bit of fun. But you know, that's one of those peculiarities you get from being in the military like that. James, are there any of the new ones that you're particularly looking forward to seeing?
I guess I have seen the new ones and that I'm aware of. So there's Cold Waters, that's in many ways the reincarnation of Red Storm Rising. And I'm terribly disappointed by the fact that they got many, many things right. And then in the AR, you can't see the enemy track unfold. So you can't learn, which drives me up the wall. You can't sit there and watch through and say, okay, I did this, I did this, I turned there, and that's where they spotted me, and that's where they launched, and that's why I got killed, or that's how they got away, or whatever it might be. And I'm baffled by that oversight, since the original Red Storm Rising had it. You could see the enemy point of view, your point of view, the overall point of view in the replay, and it's a wonderfully powerful learning tool. The other new thing that's just come out is Armored Brigade, which I have seen on a friend's computer. I don't have it yet, but it is aiming to be a new version of TAC Ops. And
it can't be. I will launch on this thing. How do you design a game like this and you don't include multiplayer?
That is one of the big questions, and it also lacks the replay mode in which you can see the enemy as well as yourself, or just the enemy point of view, and learn from where you're going. And yes. I guess my job has taught me the importance of that learn. I remember in many of the games, computer games that I had in the 80s, the 90s, whatever, I didn't have many computer games in the 80s. I had very few in the 80s. That those replays were things that you could spend, and I often did spend, at least as long as the actual mission running through, trying to understand what had happened. Falcon 3 was another one from way back in the day that I would spend sometimes longer analyzing a dogfight in its replay tools than I had spent actually conducting it, because I'm trying to understand, why did the AI beat me again? Analyze that, understand it, then go back in, apply the lessons, or at least try to, and slowly get better. But if you don't have those replay tools which let you see what was happening, then it's very difficult to really learn.
Yeah, Armored Brigade is such a terrific, terrific game, and that's what makes it such an immense disappointment. I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned when I was told it was not multiplayer.
I suppose we should probably warn some of the people that are listening at this point that we pivoted into talking about some computer games instead of just all the tabletop stuff we were doing earlier.
I blame James. He did it first.
Yeah, but,
I'll take that. I can pivot you back to board games if you'd like, though that's simply that talking about naval stuff has reminded me of the very warm spot I have still for SPI's Task Force, for all that its own designer went on to build the Fleet series, which somehow I've never managed to play. We played a lot of that when I was in college and had an absolute blast with it.
Better than Harpoon?
To my mind, Task Force, yes, was better than tabletop Harpoon, certainly, and really better than the computer Harpoon, which back then you couldn't do head-to-head, that I recall.
Correct.
Task Force was double-blind, and as a result of that, any search you made meant that you were being active. That meant you were giving away your location to some degree just by trying to look for the other side, which meant that it really had the feel of being armed with shotguns and flashlights in a dark room. And if you're going to spot the other guy, you had to turn on your flashlight. So you had to be really careful about how you did that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the idea that you guys are talking about something not having multiplayer as a part of the game, and it's like anybody that didn't realize we'd pivoted to computer games was sort of scratching their heads going, wait a minute, I put a map on the table, it's multiplayer. So if they hadn't realized it there. Michael, to the extent that you've been paying attention to some of the new stuff that is due to be released, it aside from, I'm betting you're probably waiting with bated breath for the remake of NATO Next War in Europe, but is there anything else out there that's piqued your interest for the stuff coming up?
Not really. I hate to say it, but I've been keeping my head down when it comes to games and game purchases. Actually, I've made more game purchases with stuff that's not really war game related. So, case in point, of course, this game Fortune and Glory that I've been doing the AAR for is much different from anything most people who read Armchair Dragoons are probably used to. But I've had that game a long time, but I've been acquiring a couple of games here and there that are similar to that, that are not quite Hex and Counter stuff. And every time I do that, I think I need to get back into it. And then I see something like NATO, the next Foreign Europe remake, but I just don't have the money for it right now. I'm trying to save up for a new house, and it's kind of tight. So even before, I couldn't really delve into any Kickstarters or anything like that. It's just like being in a toy store, and I just don't need to be anywhere near it.
You also live right down the street from ConSim World Expo, so I imagine somebody will have a copy there you could play next year.
Oh, I'm probably sure. And I'm sure I'll probably go next year, to be honest, because hopefully all of this stuff will be settled by then, by this time next year anyway, or by whenever it is.
Done moving around. We still can't get him to come to Origins, but we can get him to show up at ConSim World Expo. So,
hey, bring Origins here. I'll be fine.
Yeah. As long as we relocate the second largest game convention in America to your commuting distance, you know.
Yeah, I'm just saying, and it ain't going to happen. I know that, but
that's fine. Jim's still pissed they moved Gen Con out of Milwaukee. So.
That piss doesn't cover it.
Oh no, eh?
That's a little closer to James at this point, but yeah. So
when did it leave Wisconsin? Wasn't it the end of the '70s, beginning of the '80s, something like that?
When did they move it from Wisconsin?
Yeah, from Wisconsin. Sorry,
late 90s.
Really?
Oh yeah. Crap. Oh yeah. No. It was here for decades. It moved around in Wisconsin. It was originally in the Holiday Inn in Lake Geneva.
Oh, that's right. Because I remember the ads from the old Dragon magazines.
That's
and they did say that. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Brant, my favorite thing, the old Gen Con ads, moved for a number of years. Then it moved for a number of years to UW Parkside, where a lot of wonderful things happened. But then it moved to the Mecca in downtown Milwaukee, where it stayed for a whole lot of years till the 90s, certainly until 97, 98, somewhere in there. And then it's away and been gone ever since.
Yeah,
it's a shame.
You think they would have changed the name off of Gen Con since it, you know, referred to like Lake Geneva and all?
It does, but we don't. Man, can you? That is a brand. I, of course, nothing in the order of Comic Con, but when you've got a brand that's well identified, now you're kind of stuck with having to explain it for the rest of forever.
Yeah, you don't need to talk to me about building a recognizable brand and then, you know, ending up having to reboot it. One last sort of Cold War oddity to throw out there on the tabletop gaming front, and just curious if any of y'all have played with it, what your thoughts might have been, where we start to straddle the line of Cold War into post-Cold War contemporary conflicts. Force Eagles War. James, I think you and I have spoken about this one before. Have you ever actually played it or just looked through the box or just tangentially aware of it?
I have played it solitaire for probably a day's worth. The glory and the horror, so to speak, of the Tactical Combat series is the command system. And if you are playing with somebody who's willing to play within the spirit of the rules, it works beautifully well. It's really – so the command system in that is that you draw your operations graphics and issue the text of your orders on a page and then start rolling dice to find out when the troops that you've assigned this mission to are going to take it, and then they've got to execute the spirit of the order that you issued. And if you play with a rules lawyer, then it can kind of suck. And their rule book ties itself in knots trying to define its way around rules lawyers when the original version of the TCS spent far fewer sentences on it, basically saying, hey, play in the spirit or go play something else, which is really, honestly, what they need to say in the end. But the downside of the very early version of the TCS is that artillery rounds were fired into barrages by individual shell.
And, oh, good Lord.
And when you're doing a 720-round MLRS barrage, that really is a showstopper, even when you're playing just with yourself. And somebody, the name's on the tip of my tongue, and I'm forgetting who it is, because the guy is credited by Dean all over the place for doing this, did the math to build a fire table that didn't require you to figure out where every single blasted shell had landed. But it desperately needed it. The scenario was kind of odd. In that it was a U.S.-Soviet fight in the Middle East with some Palestinian units that were kind of just in the way. And it included a modification so that you could put those troops back onto the other game that was out at the time, a bulge game about the 1/10th trying to hold off the Germans when they approached us to Clairvaux. And if nothing else, it was a good shocker on the differences between the amount of firepower that units of similar size had at 50-some years apart.
Yeah, the Palestinians in Force Eagles War always struck me as more ornamental than anything. Yeah, they were there because you felt like you needed them just given the terrain you were fighting over, not that they served any real purpose whatsoever in the scenario.
Yep.
Jim, you were going to add... throwing a comment there.
No, just wondering how a barrage table requiring a 100-round barrage to be resolved by round ever got out of the playtest phase.
I think because in the first version of the game, I'm speculating here, pure speculation. If you really wanted to answer it, you could ask Dean Essick. The first game that they did was Bloody 110, and the scale of the artillery barrages was relatively small. You'd have 8 rounds or 16 or 32 at the outside landing in a bombardment. So it wasn't so horrific as, hey, I'm launching 9 tubes of MLRS with submunitions. Come eat this. which was really impressive if you got it on target, but it was too many things to drop. I suspect that it's the thing, I don't know this, but I suspect that it's the thing which convinced whoever it was to work out the statistics to build a, here's much firepower, how much firepower each hits in every hex, now do some die rolling just on the targets.
Look, we're right at our hour mark here. Although with a little bit of editing, we'll probably come in a little less than an hour. But I think at any moment, we're going to lose Michael to the sweet, sweet bliss of cold drugs and whatever else he's hopped up on right now while slightly sick. But we appreciate you soldiering on and fighting through it and joining us here on Mentioned in Dispatches. So thank you very much, Michael.
No problem. Anytime.
Well, you say any time, but like half the time we call you, you're like, yeah, I'm still at work, because you're like 3 hours behind the rest of us.
Well, I can't help that.
Yeah. Sure you can.
Closer.
Blow off the office. You'll be fine. So, Jim and James are not quite as many hours behind, but I do appreciate them staying up closer to their bedtime. So thank you, Jim, for, joining us as always. And,
always a pleasure.
And James, thank you for jumping back in here in an unofficial capacity and not putting your work hat on for a change. And
you're welcome.
And one of these days we're going to get the kids back on and we'll let the kids talk about Star Wars Rebellion and Blitzkrieg and whatever else they want to argue over. And And so thank you, audience, for surviving season one with us of Mentioned in Dispatches. We're gonna come back to you after the holidays. We'll start recording again in mid to late January and start releasing after that. And so thank you for helping us get, Armchair Dragoons off the ground. We are hoping that by the time we launch season two, we've got season one submitted to iTunes and whatever other podcast feeds are out there so that folks can start, just put in a subscription to the podcast and be able to pull things in from there. So we do look forward to you guys joining us on a regular basis, over at Armchair Dragoons. Come take a look. We've, Michael mentioned his Fortune and Glory AAR is running. We've got a variety of different kinds of articles floating around out there. We also have our event calendar. So if you're looking for some gaming near you, whether it's a convention, whether it's a club that meets on a regular basis or some other special event, come take a look at the event calendars because we are subscribing to a whole lot of different organizations, around the country. The guys up in Minnesota, a couple of folks in the Dallas area. We've got the San Diego guys with Harold Buchanan out there, are in there. The cabbies up in Ohio we've got on the calendar. If you know somebody that should be on our calendar, please point them to us so that we can go ahead and get that added to our big wargaming event calendar. Thanks, audience. Thanks, participants. We love all of y'all. Hope you enjoyed being mentioned in dispatches, and we will see you, we'll see you next year, which, you know, as we record, this is like 10 days away. But we'll see you in 2019. So thanks, everybody.